convene the Ways and Means Committee for our first meeting of the session, and
good.
A couple of the items on the agenda. One is the introduction of the committee staff, and I think what I'm going to do is ask each of them to introduce themselves and say anything that they would like relative to their role with the committee. And why don't we start with the Chief Fiscal Analyst, Bill Marks.
Thank you. Good morning. As Chief Fiscal Analyst, I'm one of the staff for this committee and work with the other fiscal staff. I just mentioned you do have a list of in your packet of fiscal staff. We have a couple changes this session, and we have a couple new fiscal analysts. Single-page list that says fiscal House Fiscal Analysis Department on it is in your folder. Just mention new fiscal staff this year. Andrew Lee will be staffing Capital Investment and Transportation. Brad Hagemeyer, Environment, Natural Resources, and Agriculture, and also helping with the Legacy Committee. And then also a change is that Melissa Johnson, who had been doing transportation and capital investment, is moving to education. Greg Crow has left the House. Jim Reinholtz has moved to be controller full-time, so they're no longer with the fiscal staff. Our job during the session often is working with the spreadsheet and putting the numbers together. It's looking at the fiscal impacts of bills, trying to figure out if there are things going on with spending, fees, revenue of various sorts within the bills. So that's largely what you'd be using us for.
Okay, and then Colby Sullivan, who's with House Research.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Colby Sullivan with the House Research Department. This is my eighth legislative session, but my first session staffing this committee. I have big shoes to fill. My predecessor, Kathy Novak, staffed this committee for many years and retired this fall. So I'm very excited about this opportunity and happy to be here.
And as we'll learn a little later, we have two Sullivans that will be working with the committee, one Colby and the other Dave. Lil Polkamp, you want to just introduce yourself and whatever you'd like.
I'm Lil Polkamp. I worked for Lynn,
Since 98.
Since 98. And I actually started in the House in 1987.
She said work for. I prefer to say work with.
Work with.
Nancy Conley.
Good morning. Administrator for this committee, and I also do state government finance. And I'll be handling fiscal requests, fiscal note requests, if anybody has any questions, and look forward to meeting, working with you all.
And is Dave Sullivan here? You know, just introduce yourself, and you have a slightly new role. You might want to just mention that to the committee.
Hello, my name is David Sullivan. I'm with House DFL Research. I'm also the coordinator for DFL Research. I'm staffing this committee as well as jobs. I staffed it for the last 2 years when it was chaired by Representative Holberg, and I also staffed the old Finance Committee several years ago when Chair Carlson was chair of that committee. And my Republican counterpart is Craig Stone.
Yeah, and that's who was next. So if he wants to come forward and say hello, he's also another recognized figure, so recognizable.
Hi, Craig Stone, GOP Research, and I started with the Senate in July 1st of 1983. But it's much better to work for the House than the Senate.
Especially right now. Okay, and let's see, Grace Doyle, our committee page. And do you want to just say anything about yourself, maybe where you went to school? Or?
Sure, I'm going to the U of M Twin Cities right now.
Okay. And then we have Leanne Schultz with House Public Information. And do you want to introduce some of the people that are with you because they're sitting in today?
Yeah, I brought our new writing staff for our session daily and all our online efforts. And I'm going to just go first names. This is Sarah. And Sarah, I used to be a reporter for the Star Tribune covering the education beat in South Southern Suburbs, right? And this is Liz. Liz is a community journalist from the Chicago area. And I don't know if any of you guys have had a chance to meet John yet. If you remember Nick Lissy, who was a writer and did a lot of work for the Pulitzer Center, Jonathan is just started with us, and he's our new electronic media coordinator, so he's heading up all our online efforts. And this is our other Jonathan, and he is a writer, editor for a magazine, and is joined us. And as I was saying to Representative, I really believe this year's staff is very thoughtful and very smart.
Okay, well, thank you to all the staff members for the introductions. I'd like to now, being that this is basically an overwhelmingly senior committee, a lot of committee chairs, ranking minority members, and so on, but Liz Holberg, maybe I'll go to her first, and we'll just go around the table. And if you could also maybe mention what committee you happen to chair, if you do, and then the committee that you're the ranking minority member of, and perhaps your district or communities that you represent, maybe how long you've been in the legislature or whatever you'd like to add to that. So Mary Liz Holberg, former chair of Ways and Means.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. Mary Liz Holberg, represent most of Lakeville. I'm the minority lead on this committee, and I've probably been here too long.
Okay. I don't think that's what you say to your constituents at an election.
That's what they say to her.
Mr. Chair. Just go right around the table.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, State Representative Bob Detmer, fourth term, Senate District 39A, which includes parts of Chisago County and much of Washington County, all the way from Forest Lake down to Highway 36 in Stillwater. And I serve on the Capital Investment Committee. I also serve, obviously, on this committee. And I'm the lead Republican on the State Government Finance and Veterans.
Okay, and maybe people could mention what they did prior to coming to the legislature or do when the legislature's not in session, because you, like the chair, are former teacher, right?
Yeah, I taught for 34 years at Forest Lake High School, head wrestling coach in various sports, and I retired in 2007, and also I just recently retired from the United States Army Reserve.
Okay. Tim?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tim Mahoney, I represent 67A, which is the northeast corner of St. Paul. I'm not going to say I have been here too long, but Representative Holberg and I are classmates. And I chair the Jobs and Economic Development Committee. I was a working pipe fitter, not a union representative, so I used to bring calluses to the committee hearing room on a regular basis, but I retired a year or there ago, somewhere in that neck of the woods, so this is now my part-time job, and the other half of the year I try to enjoy my retirement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm State Representative Paul Marquardt. This is my seventh term. I represent all or parts of Clay, Norman, and Becker County. When I'm not here, I still teach. I've taught 29 years at Dilworth, Glenn, and Felton Social Studies, and I am chairing the Education Finance Committee this term.
Okay.
I am State Representative Sarah Anderson. I represent Plymouth, and I'm so glad that the chair has a slice of heaven called Plymouth now in his legislative district due to redistricting. So,
and we started off in an early morning meeting this morning with the Robbinsdale Area Schools.
So. Good morning. I'm Representative Jennifer Loon from Eden Prairie, District 48B. Let's see, it's the beginning of my third term. And background-wise, I've worked pretty much all my career in public policy. I was a congressional staffer for a number of years and then did work in the private sector with trade associations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jean Poppy, and I represent District 27B, which is in southern Minnesota. It's Mauer County and a little one township in Dodge County, one township in Fremont County. I serve as the chair of Ag Policy, and when I'm not here, I'm a college counselor at a community and technical college in Austin.
I'm Representative Bob Gunther. I'm the lead in jobs, and I've been here, this is my 10th term, actually 9 and a half. special election. And I'm looking forward to being on this committee. First time this year.
Hi, good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Frank Hornstein. I represent District 61A, which is parts of southern and western areas of downtown Minneapolis and parts of southwest Minneapolis. And I chair the Transportation Finance Committee. And prior to my election to the legislature, I directed several different community-based nonprofit organizations addressing environmental, housing, and transportation issues.
I'm Representative Greg Davis, District 28B, Fillmore and Houston Counties, former school teacher and currently a financial planner. I've been doing that about 30 years. I'm the lead on taxes, and I'm the acting president of the Representative Mary Liz Holbrook family.
Representative Tom Hackbarth, I represent Northern Anoka County. It's 31B. This is my beginning of my ninth term, and I'm lead on the Environment Policy Committee.
Morning, Chair Carlson and members. My name is Matt Dean, and represent portions of Washington and Ramsey counties. And looking forward to serving with everybody on this committee and on the floor.
Okay, well, we'll start over with the vice chair of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tom Anzels. I represent the district in northern Minnesota, very rural in nature. Largest community is Grand Rapids, primarily Cass and Itasca counties, and I look forward to working with you.
Good morning. I'm Mike Beard. I'm representative from the Shakopee, Jackson, Louisville Township area in northern Scott County. Previously, I represented the largest district population-wise in the state, and in redistricting, I lost half of my district. So now I'm just down to Shakopee, Jackson, Louisville. I'm beginning my sixth term. I've been involved in transportation every term I've been here, so I will be the lead on transportation finance this year, cooperating with Chair Hornstein as we bring you transportation finance bills later in the session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Danny McNamara. My hometown is Hastings. I was a landscape contractor for about 3 decades before this, and I've always served on the environment committees. Thank you.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members. Carlos Mariani from St. Paul. I represent 4 or 5 neighborhoods in the central part of the city, including the neighborhood that we're sitting in. And Representative Holbrook is a youngster because I've got a few more terms on her. I'll be chairing the K-12 Policy Committee, where I'll be working with Representative Woodard and Representative Erickson to bring forward a really good K-12 bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Representative Jim Davy from District 63A. It's all or parts of 6 neighborhoods in South Minneapolis. This session, I'll be chairing the Property and Local Tax Division. You're all welcome to bring bills before me. I'm also chairing the Ethics Committee. You're not welcome to be before me there.
I'm Michael Pamar. I represent District 64B, which are 2 western neighborhoods in St. Paul. I chair the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. And when I'm not a legislator, for the last 30 years, I guess, I've been doing family violence prevention and intervention work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kelby Woodard. I represent District 20A, which is southern Scott County and western Le Sueur County. And I am lead on the Education Finance Committee. And I run a small business that's based on global security, related consulting around the world, and am an adjunct professor at St. Mary's University.
Mr. Chair, I'm Bud Dornis, state representative from District 8A. And I represent the better half of Otter Tail County, just one county, from Perham to Fergus Falls, if you're familiar at all with that part of our state, which has 10% of our lakes, just for your information. I'm the lead of on the Higher Education Committee, and this is my ninth term.
And I had lunch, Representative Nornis, Saturday with, I'm always forget whether Andy is your brother-in-law.
Brother-in-law.
Okay.
Yeah. He's doing well, right?
Yes.
Did he pay?
Yeah, he's on the New Hope City Council.
Oh, he's a little tight. Did you pay or he pay?
A battle. That's three.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kathy Breinert, and I represent the Mankato area. This is my fourth term in the legislature, and prior to that, I served on a local school board for 12 years, and professionally, I'd say I'm the Jill of all trades. I've had a wide range of professional positions, but education is among those, and I serve on a number of education committees this year.
Good morning, Jim Abler from Anoka. Actually, there's four members of our class on this committee. We've been here 14 years and 6 days, but who's counting? lead on human services, and we got our hands full. Thanks.
Good morning. Jean Wagenius. I represent parts of South Minneapolis, in the central, all the way to the south, and parts of Richfield. I will be chairing the committee on environment, agriculture, and natural resources finance. And before I came here, I was a staff attorney at the Minnesota Court of Appeals.
Gene Pawlowski, I represent most but not all of Winona County. I taught at Winona Senior High for 37 years. I'm adjunct faculty at Winona State. I've done a model legislature for now 38 years at Winona State. I played a little golf, and so has my family. And I'll be chairing Higher Education Policy and Finance.
I'm Alice Hausman. I represent a little corner of St. Paul, the cities of Falcon Heights, Lauderdale, and Roseville. And I chair Capital Investment, which writes the bonding bill.
I'm Joe Mullery. I represent about 70% of North Minneapolis, nine neighborhoods, everything north of Broadway. I represent an area which is looking to see a change. After 30 years, the legislator representing the area just to the west of ours is left, so we're hopeful the new one comes in and gets things straightened out there. Before that, I was an attorney.
What he's referring to is with redistricting, I no longer have the city of Robbinsdale.
I'm Steve Simon. I'm in my fifth term representing St. Louis Park and Hopkins, which is also where I grew up. In my other life, I'm a lawyer. I'm the chair of the elections committee this session. And I have a five-week-old daughter, so if I nod off occasionally, I'm going to rely on all of you to poke me in the ribs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we got everybody. Ann Lincheski must have had to step out for a moment, but she's... Oh, excuse me, Representative Kahn.
Yes, I'm Representative Phyllis Kahn. I'm in my 21st term, second only to the chair in seniority. And I chair the Legacy Committee. And before that, I've for many, many years chaired or was the lead on state government finance and achieved with Representative Downey last year the major collaboration of bringing all of information systems into one department. And I rely on the rest of you spread out in other committees to keep that intact and not let other department heads suddenly start to edge away on that. Before I was in the legislature, I was a research associate in genetics and cell biology at the University of Minnesota, so I had great information on discrimination against women, and I also have a strong belief in the importance of science in making decisions. And since Larry Hoche didn't run again, I still have the fastest marathon time of any sitting legislator.
And I'm Lyndon Carlson. As I mentioned, in terms of people saying what their previous occupations may have been, I'm a retired teacher, Minneapolis Public Schools, taught for many years in Joe Mullery's district in North Minneapolis, and then in later years, Northeast Minneapolis, Edison High School. Just a couple of points that we missed. We have a Jacob Grippen. I guess we had two pages. I didn't realize that. Jacob is present. And Jacob, if you could just mention who you are and maybe where you went to school or are going to school or whatever your status is.
I'm Jacob Grippen, and I recently moved up from Representative
David's
district. I went to NYU, and I'll be here on Mondays to assist Grace.
Well, welcome as well. I guess we missed you on the list earlier. apologize for that. And then when Representative Kahn says that she's the junior member to the chair, that isn't exactly accurate. We were elected at the same time, but I think the line of reasoning is that the first roll call is alphabetical and C comes before K. And we kind of go back and forth on that question, but I do have to say the last time we had an issue to settle, which was office space, we had to flip a coin. So we're the surviving members of the class.
And you won.
And I won the flip. That's right. That was another way of determining seniority forever and ever. In your packet, we do have the committee procedures, and I'm not going to walk through all of these. Just ask that you look them over. But just highlight one or two. If you're going to be absent and want to be excused, be sure you let the committee staff know so that you're listed as excused. And the other thing is that this committee, because of the timing, is often televised. We're probably about the only committee that meets at 10 o'clock on Monday. And so just kind of keep that in mind. Even if we weren't televised, we would be starting promptly at our stated time at 10 o'clock. But that's a part of the process that we're involved in here with our time frame. And hopefully some of the important issues that will be before us will draw people's attention as well. But just look those procedures over. This Mr. morning,
Chair.
We're going to...
Yeah. Well, just to those procedures, I have a comment if I could offer one.
Go right ahead.
This committee has ranged from being the Wild West to being more tightly operated in terms of amendments. Thinking back to the Knobloch stuff, and some of those committees were interesting. And this was a committee of last resort for all policy bills. And I'm kind of happy, but I also want to offer a caveat on the 24-hour rule. This committee meets sometimes on short notice with bills that have just been shortly referred to it, and so people would have no way to offer an amendment to prepare it 24 hours ahead of time. And so, I mean, you can write the rule you like, but I hope that as people come forward with amendments that are valuable and maybe even controversial, that the chair will be friendly in allowing those to be brought forward, as has been the custom in the past, but as orderly as possible. So it might hurt the author as well as of a bill as well as someone attempting to improve their bill if that rule is strictly enforced, because sometimes the bills are moving very quickly at the end. So that's just my advice to the chair.
If you read the entire, we have a 24-hour rule, and that's mainly so the staff can get the amendments prepared in the packets. But if you'll notice the second sentence, if you are unable to meet the 24-hour amendment rule, you must notify the chair to request a waiver of the rule, and basically that's just so we can plan morning and know what's coming forward. The intent is not to be, as you put it, the Wild West. We're going to be encouraging the committee chairs before the bill ever hits the Ways and Means Committee to have those bills in proper order, and there should be a need for just an absolute minimum number of amendments. Not going to say that there won't be amendments that will be coming forward, but we're going to do all that we can to encourage the chairs to and the authors, because it won't always be an omnibus bill that's before us, but to have their bills before us in good shape. Having said that, we are the last stop before the bill hits the House floor, and so if there is a need for an amendment, we'll obviously take it up, because we want to have the same philosophy on the House floor that when bills leave this committee, they're ready for floor action as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So hopefully that clarifies.
Makes a lot of sense.
So the 24-hour rule is not hard and fast. It's to give the committee a heads up. Any other questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you. Chair Carlson, I know that in the last couple of years, paying attention, there's a rule about which bills you're going to want to come before you. And in the past, we've had, what's the word, de minimis, the amount of money. And for Chair Holberg, I think it was about 1995. shipping and handling. Okay, well, not quite that bad, but do you have any kind of a marker? How do you view that, or what's your philosophy on what that is and how expensive bills have to be before they're going to be brought?
Well, I think
forward?
The House rule, if I recall, is it's $1,000 or $2,000. There is a rule that addresses that question, and it was either $1,000 or $2,000. I haven't looked at it lately. Bill?
Mr. Chair, the rule actually doesn't put a number in. It says negligible. And then it suggests that's determined by the Finance Committee Chair, the Ways and Means Chair, the Speaker, in discussions and so on. But
I'll let you know. It'll be in that range, $1,000 or $2,000. What was the number you used?
Well, it was 2,000 for years and years, but Representative Kahn, I believe, had the adding somebody else, an additional member to the Pension Commission, and I think we let that one go through as at 3. So
we'll be in that general range if that that helps. I'll take a look at that, and maybe we'll adjust for a little inflation or something, but. Basically, if a bill does have a cost, unless it's negligible, I guess, technically, is the way the rule reads, it does have to go to Ways and Means. And that's in everybody's interest, because you don't want a bill out on the House floor that has to be sent back because it doesn't fit within the budget.
Yeah. Chair Carlson. Procedure number 8, does that include iPads, iPhones?
We would like people to be paying attention in committee, so we can say electronic devices, if you would prefer to look at it that way.
Okay.
You know, it used to be years ago, I'm dating myself a bit along with Representative Kahn, but there were times when members would come in and read newspapers, and you know, that creates a certain perception with the public. Maybe people are multitasking, but some perceive it that you're not paying attention to the testimony, or if people watching it on TV, they may misunderstand what people are doing. So we would like to discourage that kind of activity so that members are being attentive, and I'm sure all of you always are, but people are left with certain perceptions sometimes if it looks like you're doing other things. Okay, anything else? Okay, with that, we do have the agenda item before us, which is an overview of the November forecast and the fiscal cliff issues. And on the November forecast, that was well publicized. I view it as a view to help us, a review to help us recall. But we've also asked basically for any information that they have now that they didn't have last November relative to the actions related to the what we call the fiscal cliff in Washington, to comment on that. You know, what we know now that we didn't know in November. So if we can begin, that will be Commissioner Showalter, State Economist Tom Stimson, and then Margaret Kelly, the Assistant Commissioner for the State Budget Director. So if the three of you could come forward, and Commissioner, do you want to go first? Or
sure.
Okay. I'll leave it up to you folks as to what order you want to go. And we do have in our packet, by the way, the handout materials that most of you will have probably seen sometime before. But
thank you, Mr. Chair.
And updated or not.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. With me is Dr. Tom Stinson, State Economist, and State Budget Director Margaret Kelly. As we get set up, we will put the slides that we're going to present on the overhead so that they can be on the screen for the audience to see. But we appreciate the chance to be here and start off this discussion, because, you know, really MMB is and its function is very close to Ways and Means. You know, we try to gather information, understand the big picture, and provide that information so that you've got some background and choices for making decisions. And that is both a process and a content challenge, because we're always speaking to different committees, different agencies, and trying to bring it together just as you are. And so we appreciate the chance to say hi again. Many of you look very familiar, but certainly as the session goes on, we'll be working very closely with you throughout this entire time. The presentation we have today that's getting set up really is something that we have put together both for explaining the forecast and also talking more recently with rating agencies. As you may know, the Wall Street credit agencies are always interested in where the state is at and what kind of information we have about our fiscal position and what kind of challenges we have. There's a couple of key things that we'll want to talk about today. They start with just a summary of the November forecast, which basically left us with the similar kind of budget challenge that we've been looking at the end of the last session, about $1.1 billion in mismatch between revenues and expenditures. We'll talk about that a little bit. More recently, we've been worrying about the federal fiscal cliff. We'll get into that and what did not happen. And in particular, I think sort of the continuous saga of uncertainty from Washington and the impacts that that may have. One possible impact is the recent economic update. And you'll have noted that we had just released that the other day. And we can talk briefly about that and some of the lingering impacts and uncertainties that are going to be rolled into the February forecast, which ultimately the legislature will use to create its budget. With that being said, let's just take a look at the first slide. We're going to zoom in just a little. And there we go. Forecast summary. A $1.1 billion shortfall remains. The changes in the last forecast really resulted mostly in changes in the current biennium. As you can see, about $1.3 billion remains in the was paid back to the shift. That was all in the current year. Unfortunately, as Dr. Stinson will explain, those improvements did not carry over to 14 and 15, so that in the end, the improvements in some areas netted out against others, and that one-time improvement paid back some of our one-time obligations, but doesn't erase them altogether. We still have and continue to have fiscal cliff uncertainty. The timing of that is going to be part of the discussion in the February forecast, but it does appear that federal funds will also be something that MMB and probably Ways and Means will continue to be looking at very closely in this year and years to come as state agencies get direction from their federal counterparts about overall spending level on a month-to-month basis. The timing of that's never really certain. The higher revenues, lower spending summary is just on this chart. And as you can see, revenues really were most of the changes that we cited in the end of November. About $1.76 billion change in 12 and 13. Fortunately, everything moved in the same way with slightly lower spending. And as a result, we ended up with a balance of $1.3 billion. As is in current law, and I think you all are pretty familiar with it, we make sure that we repay and stabilize our state's finances before moving those monies to available balance. So by statute, we replenish the reserves to the statutory level and then start to pay back any school shifts and several other items that are itemized in state law. At this point, we still have about $1.1 billion in school shifts to repay. But with this forecast, we were able to reduce the payment shift to by about $1.3 billion, raising our payment level to about 80-20. Margaret Kelly will talk about that a little bit more in a bit. The small change in budget outlook really is really quite remarkably small. The forecast revenues changes pretty much offset each other, so that a minor $68 million change. Projected spending was pretty stable as well. And so as a result, on the bottom line, you see a $16 million difference from previous estimates. That does mask some underlying changes and underlying questions about what's going to happen in 2014 and 15. And that really gets us to some of the federal fiscal cliff issues and behavioral issues about the timing of payments, the timing of activities. That introduces a significant amount of risk to this forecast. At the time of the forecast, we cited it, and I'd underscore it again, that the behavioral impacts of some of the tax law changes at the federal level really introduce different types of questions than we usually incorporate into a forecast. The backdrop, it doesn't always happen this way, but we're happy to say that there's been three successive positive forecasts. Sometimes they go well, or well being a little bit better than estimated, sometimes a little worse. We try to give you an assessment of the risks around our forecasts. In this instance, the last three forecasts have been to the good. That being said, it still hasn't helped us grow out of a structural balance problem that was really left from the previous biennial budget. At that point, we used one-time resources, namely the tobacco securitization and the school shifts, to close the budget gap. So that ongoing, so that in terms of the current biennium, spending and revenues balanced. That does not cure itself, even with three successful positive forecasts. As you can see, it's gotten better. But certainly, we are still looking at a significant challenge for this upcoming biennium.
Excuse me for a minute. One of the members asked if he or has a question, but I was going to do. Would you like to finish your presentation first and then take questions, or do you want to take them as you go? It's up
let's
to you.
Let's take questions as we go. I think okay. It would be Representative more engaging.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, because this is a timely question. Relates exactly to the point Commissioner Showalter just touched on. You talked about three successive positive outlooks. But that the growth we've had, which I think, could you tell us where it's been? It's been in the 2-point-some percent range, because you're talking about the growth in the economy, correct?
Mm-hmm.
What would we have to grow in order to grow our way out of the deficit in that you're projecting here in 14 without changing any of the tax rate? Given our current structure, how much would growth have to be? Can you got a ballpark idea?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't. I'm looking at Dr. Stinson to see if he wants to try that.
Okay.
I haven't tried to pose that kind of question about, you know, just how much GDP would have to grow.
Tom?
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, it's really not a relevant question because we're not going to grow that fast.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Beard,
just the thinking behind the question was, you know, there's two ways to grow revenue. One's to adjust rates. The other is to, as the economy grows, we just collect more, just because people are being productive and prosperous. I thought maybe there'd be an idea there about how fast we'd have to grow in order to grow our way out of it. But thank you. I thought it was relevant, but we'll see. Thanks.
Mr. Showalter.
Thank you. Certainly, that would be a good case if we were to grow our way out of it, but that hasn't been the case so far. Okay. The next chart just shows spending and the... prior to the school shift buyback. As Bill Marks and the fiscal staff can explain to you, there's really two different ways of looking at spending at any point in time when you have a statutory requirement like the shift buyback in it. And so what you're looking at here is 2012 and 14-15 changes in the forecast due to various figures and factors. I'm going to turn it over to Margaret Kelly, and she's going to walk in through these elements of the forecast in a little bit more detail.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, my name is Margaret Kelly, State Budget Director. And what this slide shows you is the change in the forecast on the spending side for both the 12-13 and the 14-15 bienniums. There really has been little change in our forecast in terms of spending, $262 million in the current biennium, $100 million in the next biennium. And you can clearly see from this table that most of the spending change is in Health and Human Services. But starting with the K-12 line, our enrollment growth has been slightly lowered in this forecast by just about 0.25%. The reduction in spending in the out years is offset slightly by increases in categorical aids. For the most part, we're continuing to see enrollment growth of about 3.2% over the forecast period. It's just a little less than we had earlier projected. Moving down onto property tax aids and credits, the reduction in spending here is primarily in the property tax refund area. And this forecast is reflecting two trends. First, that the tax burden is shifting away from homesteads to other property types. And second, that the housing market is shifting slightly away from home ownership. And given those two trends, our forecast for property tax refunds has been reduced slightly. I'm going to come back to Health and Human Services and speak first to debt services. This forecast is also down slightly, primarily driven by favorable interest rates when we sold our bonds and the fact that we sold a smaller amount of bonds than we had originally forecasted previously. The all other line is a little more change here than we usually see. The about $113 million of the $139 million growth in the 14-15 biennium is due to the refunding of the tobacco settlement revenue bonds that we did a few months ago with appropriation bonds. This refunding saved the state about $85 million over the life of the bonds, but it changes the way we show the cost of those bonds in our fund statements. So now the debt service for those bonds is paid out of the general fund, and the revenue, the tobacco revenue, will be also coming into the general fund, so there's an offset on the revenue side of the picture that Dr. Stinson will talk about in a minute. So going back up to the Health and Human Services line, the change here, it's less than a 2% change from the previous forecast, and it's primarily driven by medical assistance or our Medicaid program, the state Medicaid program. First, the average cost of care and several components of the MA program has been lowered in this forecast. And in a few other components of the MA program, there is lowered caseloads as well. And those are two of the major driving forces in why this forecast is down. A third reason is that we have additional pharmacy rebates. This is a newer component that we are forecasting as a result of the Affordable Care Act, where we receive pharmacy rebates on our Medicaid are on our managed care side of our business in addition to fee-for-service. And so we have additional revenues coming in there over what we had previously forecasted. If you look on the bottom line there, the school shift buyback.
When you're done, she has a question.
The school shift buyback will actually add spending to the current biennium. And I just want to make one more comment on the Health and Human Services line of spending. What we assume in this forecast, at the time we did the forecast, we were assuming that we would have federal match on our component of the early expansion in our Medicaid component and our MA component. And With the Supreme Court decision around the Affordable Care Act saying that the states were no longer mandated to expand their Medicaid populations, we reduced our expansion from 138% of the federal poverty guideline down to 75%. But we were still assuming 100% match on that 75% component. Since the forecast was released, the feds have come out to say that they will only provide 100% match on the if you expand your population up to 138% of poverty. And so there is a big risk in this forecast for a swing in assuming federal match versus 100% at the state.
Yes, well, Mr. Chairman, besides being a scientist, I'm actually married to a mathematician, so I also believe in arithmetic and in things like the sanctity of equations, i.e. if you put something on one side to balance it, you need to put the same thing on the other side. And the thing that has frustrated me for a while in our budget projections, and I just want to know how it's figured into this, is that we count inflation on the revenue side in making our forecasts. We assume that tax collections is going to be subject to inflation, but we don't allow ourselves to count it on our spending side. What has been done in this budget, and are we making any attempt to deal with that?
I'll start. Certainly. I think the committee or a number of the members are aware that in statute, the forecast numbers are supposed to not include discretionary inflation on expenditures. While there is some cost pressure figures that are included in the human services trends, mainly basically so that managed contract numbers are sensible, and reflect current law because they need to close those contracts. In general, discretionary inflation isn't shown on other numbers. It's really just showing what the appropriation is. As Margaret or I talk more about the long-term trend, that lack of inflation on the expenditure side becomes more obvious because revenues do include some measure of CPI growth, some measure of inflation, even though it's relatively low right now. That trend tends to close the gap between spending and revenues over time. There's not a discretionary act that we took with this forecast because really it is a matter of state law as to whether inflation is included in our numbers or not.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, again, if you just look at it as an equation, there's a very easy way you could do it. You don't have to include it in the revenue forecast if it's not included in the outgoing focus. Or you could also, as part of your budget, bring a suggestion to the legislature that they get rid of that piece of the statute. Either one would work in terms of, I don't know, it doesn't work in terms of your manipulating numbers, but either one of them would work in keeping the arithmetic solution pure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, we have taken one third option, which is we repeatedly show discretionary inflation whenever we talk about long-term budget projections, and so in almost any setting, you will see a separate line showing discretionary inflation so that you have a good sense of, on a very simple basis, what the impact of inflation would be on the spending numbers and can draw your conclusions as to the balance, relative balance between spending and revenues.
And Commissioner, you do show it on the last page here of the forecast as well.
Yes.
But it's not figured into the numbers up to that point. Yeah.
In the interests of purity, it would be nice if you showed that on the other side, too.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is true, and certainly that's been a recommendation from the Council of Economic Advisers for many years, is that that gets addressed through legislation. Representative Clark.
We're going to run long, which would really be silly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question. One of the changes that you mentioned was in the property tax aids and credits, and you indicated that we have a shift away from homestead and from home ownership. Do you have some more numbers to tell us about that, or is that something you could check into? Like, what are we talking about in terms of quantity and actual numbers that we've lost in terms of homeowners?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I would need to provide you additional data. I don't have that with me, but it's a very slight, ever so slight shift. But
thank you.
Okay, that's all the questions at this point. If you want to continue, I think we're probably moving to Dr. Stinson next when I look at the next page, right?
Yes, we are, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, the slide that we have up now indicates where the changes in revenue occurred between the forecast and the prior end of session estimates. And the title of the graph is a little bit misleading, and it says revenue growth does not carry into 14 and 15. It's not that the revenues don't grow. They actually grow by $849 million or 2.4%. It's just they don't grow as fast as were projected in February when we did the prior forecast. If we look at 12 and 13, revenues grow faster than we thought they would in there. $1.076 billion or about 3.2% faster than we thought. Most of that, $709 million or $709 million of it comes from the individual income tax, the sales tax, and the corporate income tax. Almost all of the individual income tax growth comes from non-wage income, and almost all of that non-wage income comes from increases in capital gains. When we did the forecast in February, we were aware that the Affordable Care Act changed the tax rate on non-wage income for high-income individuals. But since it was under consideration by the Supreme Court, we didn't want to include that as part of our current law estimates, since it would produce additional revenue for the state in the current year. And if that were to be knocked out, then we would face financial problems that we didn't want to set the state up for. So we assume that the tax rate on federal tax rate on capital gains would be 15% when we did the February forecast. When we did the November forecast, the court had already ruled that the Affordable Care Act was constitutional, and so at that point we changed our assumptions on capital gains rate, and that change in assumptions produced a considerable amount of revenue looking into tax year 2012. For tax year 2012, we now have capital gains growth of 59%. In February, we had 16% growth. Some of that comes from tax years 13 and 14, an acceleration of gains taken early, taken in December of 2000, or earlier in the year of 2012. That causes tax year 13 realizations to drop by 49% compared to what we had there. And then for 2014, they grow again by 26%. The sales tax and corporate income tax both grow. Sales tax grows at relatively normal rates. The corporate income tax grows faster, reflecting what we've seen in the receipts up to date. For 2014-2015, we have $68 million decline in the forecast compared to the planning estimates that were made at the end of the legislative session. Of that, $548 million is a decline in individual income tax. About half of that comes from slower wage growth than we expected. About half of it comes from slower capital gains growth. $124 million in sales tax, $137 million in corporate tax, and $219 million in other income and other tax receipts. Of that $219 million, $130 million of that comes from the change in the treatment of the tobacco revenue and the payment of tobacco bonds as appropriation bonds. The next slide is out of date. It shows what we thought would happen if we went over the fiscal cliff. And just real briefly, because we talked about this a great deal at the time we released the forecast, the fiscal cliff would reduce employment 45,000 and by 45,000 jobs in 2013. It would reduce employment by 70,000 jobs from the baseline growth rate in 2014. So that in 2014, instead of growing by 100,000 jobs in employment, we would have only grown by 30%. If we'd gone over the fiscal cliff, the unemployment rate would have gone to 7.1% in the state. It was expected under the baseline to fall to 5.3%. And personal income would fall by 4% by 2015, and state revenues would fall by $1.7 billion in 14 and 15. None of that's going to happen because of the fiscal cliff, because the fiscal cliff has been taken care of more or less. But the problem is that we have this issue, the debt ceiling, that's sitting out there. And while it's been relatively easy to come up with numbers that would tell you what happens if you go over the fiscal cliff, because there are dollar values that are attached to each of the provisions and they're easy to put into the forecasting models that we have, the debt ceiling issue is much more behavioral, it's much more psychological, and it depends a lot more on the behavior of capital markets. And so while most economists think that the situation would be much worse if we go over the debt ceiling limit and we have credit rating cut, there aren't really good estimates in there. Now, there's a problem, and the problem is that economists are beginning to sound pretty alarmist because it seems like we just get by one crisis, and we're telling you, oh, no, but there's a bigger crisis coming down the road, and then a bigger crisis coming down the road after that. And we certainly don't want to do that. Most economists, in fact, almost all economists, think that the debt ceiling issue is recognized by Congress and the President to be serious enough and to have serious enough implications for not only the U.S. economy but the global economy, so that we will not run up against the wall on the debt ceiling, we won't default on our payments, we won't get downgraded from AAA by Fitch and Moody's. But there still is that possibility, and that I just want you to be aware of that possibility. Now, when we do the forecast in February, unless things are different than we suspect, we're not going to know the answer to this. We're not going to know that the debt ceiling has been extended or not extended until after the forecast is done, probably. We will be assuming that the debt ceiling is extended, that we don't go over the debt ceiling problems in there. But that's just an uncertainty that we have on there.
So, Dr. Stinson, you just make that assumption then that it will be extended rather than giving us two different scenarios?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Going to the next chart, this just shows you the capital gains issue. You know, I talk about this capital gains issue so much that I'm sure that most of you think that I don't think of anything else but capital gains, and you're right, I don't. But it's a major source of risk. In 2012, we have 59% growth rate, and we will have a higher growth rate in the forecast because of the solution where higher income individuals now face a 20% base rate plus the additional 3.8% rate on the Affordable Care Act. So we're going to have this capital gains rate going up even faster. That's going to bring more money into tax year 2012 and fiscal year 2013, and then there will be a larger cutback in tax year 2013 and 14 and in fiscal years 2013 or 14 and 15. So that's just some warning as to what's going on there. Some other issues that we're going to have to deal with that were brought on because of the fiscal cliff is acceleration of income in other types of income. Dividends, some firms accelerated their dividends so their high-income individuals would face a lower tax rate than if they were paid in tax year 2013. Walmart, $1.3 billion. Costco, $3 billion are two examples of firms that accelerated their dividends into 2012. All in all, Global Insight thinks about $10 billion of dividends were accelerated into the tax year 2012. Proprietors' incomes, to the extent that you're a high-income law practice or medical clinic or proprietor's income of some sort and had the opportunity to accelerate income, that will likely have been done, and we'll have to take that into account. Bonuses and stock options also were probably accelerated into 2012 and out of 2013, so we'll have to be taking that into account at all as well. So we're going to be seeing Our best guess at this point is that we're going to be seeing more income shifted into tax year 2012, more income shifted into the current biennium, and then that income not showing up in tax years 2013 and 14. We have some good news that came out on the 10th. This is the first report that we have of our December and November revenue receipts. They were $114 million above forecast, or about 3.9%. The individual income tax, two pieces of that that are worth noting. One is that withholding receipts were up $29 million from forecast. We think probably that's from people accelerating income and taking stock options in 2012 rather than waiting 2013, but we'll see what happened there. $16 million of it is individual estimated payments, and the timing on that is hard to, well, it's very inconsistent, and so we can't really count that as being a plus or a minus at this point. This will be something that we'll have better information on at the end of January when fourth quarter estimated payments have all been made and processed. The sales tax is down $40 million.
On that 114, just now, as I understand it, there's potentially one more payment to school districts. So if there were no change, and we all understand that number could change one way or the other, but that would be an additional payment to the school districts come February then?
Mr. Chair, that's March? Correct. The statute basically triggers changes in the payments after each of the forecasts. So after the February 28th forecast, if we showed money in the current budget year to be on the bottom line, we would then change the ratchet up of the school payments to pay down that shift.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry, Dr. Stinson. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, the sales tax number that we have, $40 million less than we received, that doesn't completely reflect the Christmas shopping season. That reflects sales that were made in the months of October and November because retailers remit to the state the month following the month that they collect the sales tax. Still, we're down $15 million in gross sales tax receipts, $20 million for the month for sales made in the month of November in there. The other $25 million comes from higher than expected sales tax refunds. Sales tax refunds are erratic in their timing, and so at this point, this is something that we'll be looking at, but it wouldn't necessarily hold true. The big question is what's going on with the corporate tax receipts, where we're $93 million or 50% more than we had forecast in November. Some of that, a small amount of it, is due to some audit, some large audit activity that we wouldn't have normally gotten. But $77 million of that is due to estimated payments by corporations being at record highs. December's payments were record levels. The change was enormous. And we're looking now to see if we can explain why that would be. There don't appear to be any obvious things going on with the fiscal cliff, although there may be things that we just haven't caught on to at this point. It's more likely, we think, that corporate profits are just higher than were thought. That could be. If that's true, that money would carry on into the future. If it's not true, some of that money would be refunded in tax year 2014. The final thing that I want to note is that if you look at the $114 million, if you do not include the corporate, which we're not sure what to do with at this point, the variance is a much more reasonable $37 million in there. We have gotten a report, a new forecast from Global Insight. This forecast was made after the agreement on the fiscal cliff was reached, and so it reflects Global Insight's perceptions of what the changes would be given what the changes were in the fiscal cliff negotiations. It does not assume that the U.S. Treasury runs up against the debt limit and defaults, or that there's a AAA, a loss of the AAA rating for our credit. And what you see is that there really isn't a lot of change. The first quarter of 2013, there's a big drop, a drop from 2.4% to 1% growth, and then there's a little bit of a surge in the second quarter of 2013. But in general, we're doing just, we're expected to do just a little bit worse than we were in November. Global Insight will come up with a new forecast that we will discuss with our Council of Economic Advisors sometime after the 1st of February. We'll discuss this forecast with them, as you well know, sometime before the end of the month, and find out better what other people think is going on. But the changes to this point in the economy are not great. For 2013, in November, we were expecting 1.9% real GDP growth. Now we're expecting 1.7%. For 2014, 2.8% versus 2.7%. In 2015, 3.3% versus 3.4%. So, you know, these are all very, very small changes. Global Insight's outlook for 2013 is 0.3% below the blue chip consensus of 2.0%. It puts a, their forecast in the bottom quarter of the 50-plus forecasters who provide material to the blue chip. Their forecast for 2014 of 2.7% is slightly above the blue chip consensus, puts them in the top half in there. Again, they're assuming that there's no default going on. The probability of a pessimistic scenario, more pessimistic scenario, is set at 20%. The baseline is 60%, and the optimistic scenario at 20%. We will be getting the February forecast on February 6th, and we'll be working on it and be ready to present the forecast, the February forecast, on February 28th to you.
Okay, we did have a couple of hands that went up. Dr. Stinson, the first one is Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Stinson, if the November-December revenue holds at $114 million surplus, and currently we have about an 82.5, 17.5 school shift. Do you know what those numbers would be with the $114 million added to the payback of the school shift, the percentage?
I'm trying to remember, but I think it's about $10 million per point.
Yeah, we had a...
So, can't be right. A tenth of a point?
So we... Looks to me like $100 million per point. For tenth of a point.
Representative Marquardt, did you have something to add there?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe it's $70 million per 1%. Mm-hmm. So if it would be 114, it would be about a percent and a half, I suppose. I thought that was the number, about 70 million per 1% shift.
Representative Woodard.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hey, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Dr. Stinson. If the debt limit is not extended, the country would not go into default because the interest on the debt would still be paid. We can spend about 60 cents on every dollar that's due. I was kind of getting the feeling that when you're talking about debt limit not being extended, you're talking about default. Those two are two separate issues, because if the debt limit is not extended, the country would not go into default because the interest on the debt would be paid. Is that correct?
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, I don't think anybody knows what the Treasury's solution would be to dealing with a situation where you have enough money coming in on a current basis to cover 40% of your obligations and 60% remain uncovered. Certainly, one of the things that you do would be to stop paying individual income tax refunds and corporate income tax refunds. That's worth about $85 billion and would make up about half of the gap that is expected to occur. But there's about $170 billion in 2 weeks. And so then the question is, do you pay interest on the debt, or do you pay Social Security recipients? Do you pay military payments? Do you pay Medicare payments in there? And it's my understanding that what's being thought is that you would just kind of line payments up, and if there's enough money to pay a day's costs in the bank, then you would pay them. If there's not, you wait until there's enough money to pay it. It would just be on a day-by-day basis. But you could try to prioritize it as well.
Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dr. Stinson. Shifting gears just a bit, we've referenced the Affordable Care Act several times. We were told with the Affordable Care Act that the average family would see a $2,500 reduction in health insurance premiums. Actually, they've gone up $3,000 and are projected to go up possibly another 50% in 2013. So how will you calculate the money that is taken out of the economy to pay the increase in health premiums up to 50% above an already increased of $3,000? How is that factored into putting a drag on the economy or slowing the economy down and showing reduced collections from income tax because people will have less income? How are you calculating the Affordable Care Act situation into the forecast?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Global Insight, our national macroeconomic consultant, provides us with a model of the U.S. economy that takes these things into account. We'll look at them, assess the reasonableness of their assumptions, but it's very likely that we will follow what their lead is on this. And so that's how we will do it. What'll happen is that whatever additional amount of money is going to insurance payments will then be taken away from spending on consumer durables, consumer non-durables, and other services. In there, there'll be some drawdown of savings possibly as well, and that'll all work through the model, give us a growth rate for the economy and for the particular sectors that we're concerned about.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Doctor.
Yeah. Commissioner? Or Dr. I'm not sure who's got the next slide. Is that Dr. Stinson?
I think we're getting towards the end of our presentation. As we started this discussion,
Go ahead.
The state's fiscal condition is certainly improved as the economy has recovered. The Great Recession certainly created a lot of issues for us, but That being said, we haven't righted the ship. That one-time actions that we've used in the past to resolve our budget deficit leave us with challenges in the 2014-15 budget period of a little over $1 billion. That's a significant set of choices that we're going to have to make going into this. Beyond that, I think it's really imperative for this committee to understand the kinds of risks that as a state we need to manage. I think combined, we all know there's always going to be risk. That's just, you know, a given. What we try not to do is work ourselves into a situation where we have to take dramatic actions in order to keep things going. The federal government certainly is getting into that position where it is having to make dramatic decisions, but as a state, we make sure that we have the reserves. We try to pay down our shifts so that we've got fiscal flexibility if and when the unexpected happens. The state policy to restore those has been a very solid one, and we're certainly making improvement there. So those are the kinds of challenges that we're looking at going ahead, even as we try to make sure that we've got a longer-term focus in making sure that we have our structural balance. The last slide just shows you the 2014 through 2017 projected revenues and projected spending. As Representative Kahn suggested before, the spending does not include a factor of inflation. So really what you see there is a growth in enrollment in health and health care, to a much lesser extent in K-12, along with the projected changes in revenues. Over time, without that inflationary factor, you certainly see things coming together and, in fact, slightly positive. But that does not really mean that, you know, when you get to that point in time, that there's not going to be very real pressures that are captured by the discretionary inflation. But that's where we want to get. In the past, Minnesota has tried to balance its budget, not only in the current biennium, but also over the long term. And I think that's kind of the marker for financial discipline that we should be putting back in front of ourselves. So with that, that concludes our presentation. Be happy to address any questions that you might have.
Okay, Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this might get a little bit at Representative Beard's questions earlier. I pulled the November 2010 forecast just to kind of look at, you know, where we've been over the last 2 years, and in the November 2010 forecast, the revenues were projected at just over $32 billion for the 12-13 biennium. Now I see we're looking at it, it's going to be closer, much closer to $35 billion. What would you say would be the top one or two reasons for that increased revenue over the last 2 years off of where we were in the November 2010 projection?
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holder, capital gains would certainly be one of the major ones, and the changes in the capital gains tax rate at the federal level, you know, we couldn't anticipate that the Affordable Care Act would be passed, let alone that it would have an increase in the capital gains rate for high-income individuals. And so capital gains would be one of the keys. Second is that while I'm not 100% sure, I would suspect that the economy has done just a little better than we thought in November of 2010. I mean, the economy has come back, but we have not come back to where we were in early or late 2007 yet at this point.
And if you know about how much of that $3 billion would you attribute to capital gains?
I could tell you with some other material that I have. I'll send that to you, but I don't have that information now. And in fact, I can give you, you know, we pay attention to where the changes are coming from. And so I can give you a more complete breakdown.
And I appreciate that generally we're looking forward, but sometimes it helps to look back a little bit. And in that 2010 forecast, it looked, in 14-15, it looked that revenues were going to be at $34,595, and now we're at $35,793. Now, from what I understand, that wouldn't be because of capital gains, because you're going to think we're going to get most of that coming in this biennium. Any idea as far as where we see that growth in revenue in the out years over the past 2 years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holmer. Without having more material in front of me, I can't tell you for sure. I'm not sure, for example, whether the change in the treatment of tobacco made a big difference or not. That could make a big difference in that.
Right, and okay, all right.
Representative Holmberg.
Thank you. And just right now, I know that we're looking at a $1.1 billion shortfall, and you add in inflation, you're at about two. But some members may recall the number for this biennium for the shortfall was over $5 billion, and with inflation, almost eight. So I think we have made some progress in the 14, 15 years, if you look where we were 2 years ago.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I may add, I think Representative Holberg's comparison of bienniums is an apt one, and one that we always try to take. I think as we look at these years, it's going to be a challenge, I think, of logic, trying to sort of tear apart some of these biennial comparisons as well, simply because there are a lot of interesting one-time things, and the timing of them changes. You know, as Dr. Stinson mentioned, the tobacco revenues. Even at the end of session, we were treating that as a decrease to our debt service obligations, so spending went down because we were securitizing tobacco revenues over time. As of this forecast, because of the Supreme Court action, they now show up both as increased spending and increased revenues. And so those biennial comparisons, while important and a normal part of our analysis, are also going to be very tricky. And I hope that we can keep on trying to talk through all of those factors to get to the truth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We've got time for one more question, and then we'll need to adjourn by 10:30. Representative Kahn.
Actually, this is just a comment. Those of you who are at the One Minnesota meeting know that that Dr. Stinson didn't make it because he had the flu. So to check up to see if he's as smart at everything as he is in economics, I called him to check if he had gotten a flu shot and found out that he definitely had, and that's why it only lasted one day. So let that be a lesson to the rest of us.
And being that wasn't the question, now we do have time for one more. Representative Anderson has indicated she has one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be brief. Dr. Stinson, can you tell me, I believe in 2016, 2017, aren't we showing that we're going to have $216 million surplus in that biennium? Can you verify that for me, please?
Dr. Stinson?
It's on the screen, and $29 million and $234 million would be $263 million.
Yeah, we have just a couple of quick announcements. Ms. Fulcamp has put in a save file, so if any of the materials that come in you want to keep for future reference, put them in the save file, otherwise they'll be cleaned out. And the other thing is that next Monday is Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday holiday, so we will not be meeting. So our next meeting of this committee will be on January 28th, 10 a.m., this room again, with an overview of the governor's budget recommendations. So, again, that will be on Monday the 28th. So if there's no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.